A warm welcome and a good morning. And the topic today for Dharma in Pajamas is how to get dressed. So, you know, for some people, it's just a natural, easy thing to do. And for other people, you wake up and you just go, oh my God, I've got nothing to wear, which may actually be an indication of something a little deeper about just not feeling comfortable in our skin or not quite knowing which identity to step into. So how to get dressed, even from a Buddhist point of view, how to get dressed. Getting dressed can become part of our path to enlightenment as well, which is a bit of a relief, really, because getting dressed can be one of those tedious chores that's just relentless, like the rest of life maintenance chores that would be so great to get out of, but nevertheless we have to do it. So let's set our motivation for this morning again of kindness and curiosity is one kind of informal way of putting it, the Buddhist way of how to get dressed. So one of the main incentives for bringing getting dressed onto the path is that if you've ever had that thought, oh my gosh, I don't have time to meditate or I don't have time to study, this is one of the ways that you can, it's like a life hack, a Buddhist life hack of how to actually bring all of the Dharma activities, hitchhike them onto those tedious chores that we have to do. So years ago, I remember seeing a Loenig cartoon, Michael Loenig cartoon of Mr. Teapot or whoever the dude is sitting on his bed, kind of looking a bit shell-shocked, and the sign in front of the bed says, pants first, then shoes, which really, I tried to find it online, but I couldn't find it. It really sums up how when we're befuddled, we can actually get things so wrong, can't we? And it just makes life worse. So pants first, then shoes. And from a Buddhist point of view, there's a huge amount that we can do to bring meaning to this tedious chore. Also, if we don't, then what can happen is getting dressed, putting on makeup, whatever, can actually just increase the delusions or increase our afflictive states of mind, because we're identifying very strongly with our body as us, and we can develop pride and egocentricity and competitiveness. And it's very easy for it to go from a neutral motivation to one that's kind of certainly not about the welfare of others. So what can we do to make it at least not even just neutral, because then that's just a great big waste of time, but to actually make it meaningful? So with everything that we do, of course, no one's going to tell us what the meaning of life is. We have to bring meaning to our life. It's because it's us who's experiencing it. So it's us who has to really see the potential and the meaning there. So what can we do? Some of the starting things to do is that a lot of the ornaments that we put on can represent the six perfections. So as we put on ornaments, we can put on some of the perfections. So for instance, when you put on earrings, I have one here. Here's what I prepared earlier. Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, your ears are made to hear problems. And so when you put on your earrings and you think, oh, may I develop the perfection of patience and joyously listen to the problems of others. So there we go. I've put on my perfection of patience. May I be adorned with the perfection of patience. When you put on a belt, you can think, may I be supported by my enthusiastic perseverance, that kind of joyous energy and effort that we put into our life. When we put on our shoes, what can we do with the shoes? one of the nicest ones is, as I step into my shoes, may I follow the footsteps of the Buddha. When we put on a watch, so instead of just putting on a watch, we can think, well, I always, the first thing I dedicate for is, may I have enough time? May I live long enough to complete the works of Lungri Tungpa Senna, which actually might be that I have to live 1,000 years, but, you know, may I offer time, may I offer my time to others. And for the anything that we wear on our wrist, anklets, bracelets, it's almost like, may I be the hands and feet of the guru. And they represent morality or ethics, because it's kind of embodied what we do. So may we be beautified by our morality. May we be beautified by whatever vows that we hold, by our ethics. So when Loinig said pants first, then shoes. So when you put on your trousers or stockings, you might remember in a lot of the imagery of the deities, Tara, Chenrezig, Manjushri, they all wear rainbow stockings, stripy socks. It's not because they're gothic, but the stripy socks or the rainbow stockings or putting on the trousers can actually, it actually represents the rainbow body or the light body of a Buddha. So every time you put your socks on, you can think, may I achieve the rainbow body? Why do we want to do that? Because to help sentient beings, we need to have a, we need to manifest a form. So the perfect form of a Buddha, the rainbow body, the body made of light, indestructible. So it's a great way to put on your socks. what else can we do? Then necklace. So this one is great. So the necklace represents generosity. And with the imagery, you'll see that many of the deities have either one or three necklaces, because there's three types of generosity. And this is also represented in the imagery of the Buddha. The Buddha has three necklines, so three kind of like not wrinkles but lines. And that too represents the three types of generosity. So the first type of generosity is the generosity of giving material goods, medicine, food, giving your stuff away, supporting others. So you can think, as I put on this necklace, may I perfect, may I develop the perfection of generosity. May I always have a generous heart and give whenever I can and support others materially. So sometimes I recognize how hard that is to do. You know, you've got the all the pieces of cake, and I always go for the best piece. And I'm quite embarrassed about that. I don't go for the smallest, worst, broken down piece and offer the others. I just want the best one. It's so greedy. So, you know, every time I put jewelry on, then I try and think about that of, okay, offering to others first. So first part of generosity is that. The second part of generosity, so here's my next necklace, is to offer safety. And as part of that, we can also offer offer love. So offering safety, saving lives, protecting the vulnerable. So this is kind of one necklace, but it's two. And there's many ways that we can protect the vulnerable. We can offer the couch for someone to stay on when they're homeless or been thrown out of home. We can go and give blood to save lives. We can volunteer at, like, how people, the firefighters, how much of Australian firefighting efforts is from volunteers, literally saving lives. We can also donate to charities that save lives. Protecting the vulnerable or offering love. Also, when someone is suffering, to show them compassion instead of recoil, how we often do towards grief, for instance. and to protect the vulnerable if someone is being abused or bullied. So there's many, many ways that we can do that. So when you put the necklace on, then you can think, or if you a necktie, whatever it is that you put around your neck, even your device string of your earbuds or whatever, to remember to set the motivation to be ready for sentient beings if they need help that day, because the attitude's there. And the third type of generosity, the generosity of giving the Dharma. So giving the Dharma, giving education, helping people help themselves. So sharing your own experience, giving Dharma books, not just commiserating with people, but offering a Dharma insight that's going to be appropriate, that's going to actually help them. So all of that, as you're putting on your jewelry in the morning, you know, it's part of the perfection of generosity. What else can we do? Then makeup. So makeup is a fantastic one. Eyebrows. So you know when I'm dressed because I put my eyebrows on. So with the putting the eyebrows on, really, they're like the two wings of a bird, aren't they? How Venerable Rabina talks about it. And even if I get them a bit wrong, at least this is what I'm thinking about. Instead of developing my egocentricity and pride, I'm thinking, okay, and what are the two wings of the bird? We need equally both compassion and wisdom. So there's the two wings of the bird. By me putting on my eyebrows, may I fully develop the two wings of the bird and lead all sentient beings to out of suffering and into the enlightened state. Mascara. Okay, so here's another one with the eye. So as we've got the top and the bottom part of our eyes, and what are the eyes? They see. So one of them is we can make a prayer. May I develop the Deva's eye. So the Deva's eye is a form of clairvoyance, but it's not clairvoyance to be able to rip people off. It's clairvoyance to be able to see exactly what people need, to know exactly what's going to benefit them, and to be able to see past and future, to be able to see into the hearts of others in order to help them better. So may I develop the Deva's eye, the compassionate eye. May I be beautified by the compassionate eye. And the other thing with the eye, because there's the top lid and the bottom lid, then you can think about the two truths. So ultimate truth and relative truth. Whether it's the two lids or whether it's each eye, this eye, the long game, the ultimate truth, the wisdom realizing emptiness. This eye, relative truth. Who's in front of me now? Skillful means. So by now we're getting really focused for the day, isn't it? How am I going to live my day? And then lips. So partly may we be able to really share our Buddhist wisdom and whatever we say, as the Buddha said, when we speak, the three things. So true, obviously, may what we say be true, but not just true, because the truth can come too quickly for people, or it can upset them if said unskillfully. So true and kind. So that's one of the top lips. And the other one is useful. So not just a nice thing to say, but something that is going to help, that if people remember it, they'll be able to draw inspiration or something really practical from. So there we've made up our face, but what's the face? It's not the face of pride. It's the face of trying to put forth the face of a bodhisattva. And, you know, that comes from actually practicing it, embodying it. And so this kind of ritual, especially that women do, but, you know, guys, they shave as well. So, you know, there's something that we do every day. This is like a life hack, a Buddhist life hack. If we're going to do it every day, even if we don't meditate every day, we can do this to set our bodhicitta motivation. The other thing, of course, with the lips and when you're offering your food is may everyone have the nourishment of the Dharma, and may the Dharma be delicious to them. Okay, so then last thing, hair. So this is how I do my hair. Done. It's how my mother did her hair before me as well. So this one was a bit tricky for me because, you know, the Buddha's hair, each strand coiled individually to the right. So the Buddha had like a blue-black hair, a little bit like an afro. But the significance of the hair, each one being curled individually to the right, shows that the thoughts of the Buddha are perfect, untangled, distinct. So when I do my hair like this, this is kind of like the opposite of that. So I was trying to figure out how on earth do I transform that one. So one, of course, is that may, just as I want my hair to be balanced, may I have equanimity. May I not be biased, may I not have any favoritism towards others, but respond to all sentient beings with equal care because they have a mind, they have a heart, they all suffer. Because they have feelings, they matter. So at least may I have balance. And, you know, maybe as I get out the little knots and the whatever, then may my thoughts be untangled. May my mind be clear. What else? And then when you put on your jacket or your cloak, your superpower cloak, so this is like our cloak of becoming an inner professional, and this is a superpower that as we put in on our cloak, actually the way to think of it is may we be protected by the three higher trainings. So the three robes of a Buddha that a Buddha wears represents the three higher trainings. And so they are, I mean, the ordinary trainings, we've talked about them before, they're just skills for life that we need. So we need to be able to concentrate. We need to act ethically and we need wisdom. But the three higher trainings aren't just those things for an ordinary everyday life. They're higher because their purpose isn't just to concentrate and make money or be competitive, but their purpose is with a mind of renunciation towards samsaric existence, releasing the ups and downs, the continuous ups and downs of ordinary life, and putting on the cloak of these higher trainings for liberation and enlightenment. So why do we need to concentrate? Not just to make more money and get tighter and tighter and more miserable. We need to be able to concentrate to tame our mind, to release ourselves from suffering. We need ethics because how can we do anything if we're not comfortable in our own skin? We need to embody the teachings. And so part of this getting dressed is bringing what can just be an aspirational thought or even something that we think, well, yeah, that's nice, but it's not very practical. It's not very realistic in this modern dog-eat-dog world. So it's actually bringing all of that into our life today, embodying our ethical conduct by figuring out how to get dressed. So we put on our ethical conduct so we feel comfortable in our own skin, so we are trustworthy and we have confidence ourselves. And then the wisdom, the higher training of wisdom. So this isn't just to get smart, to be smarter than others, or to assuage our curiosity, but it's a particular kind of wisdom, isn't it? It's the wisdom that understands our nature, the nature of phenomena, understands that there is no real way that things exist, that it all depends. So this way of getting dressed changes that concrete way that we have of looking at things as being ordinary. And it kind of whittles away at that, and it can develop our wisdom by recognizing that everything that we do affects everything else. And if we bring this really deep story to getting dressed, we can begin to embody the bodhisattva activities and attitude. And even if we're no good at it, it's still going to change everything profoundly. It'll change your day-to-day life. It'll change how you feel about yourself. And it also helps if we, you know, because we get dressed in the morning before we go out into the world, it sets us in a right direction. And so then as we go about our day, we don't have to keep on thinking, oh, what am I doing again? Oh, I'm supposed to be trying to be a good person. We're already got the momentum. We can actually, you know, now we've got it started, now we can just continue in that direction. So the cloak of our superpowers, our ethical conduct, and so this, the inner professional as well, is to do with, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, you know, we all have to become an inner professional. We understand about professionalism and we expect people to be professional, especially people, politicians and bankers and teachers and doctors. We expect them to have no bias, to have a code of professional conduct, to not take advantage of the vulnerable, you know, to not have an affair with your student or your patient for X amount of years after, you know. All of those things, they're codified there in a professional code of conduct. So as a bodhisattva, on the bodhisattva path, we also have a professional code of conduct, being the inner professional, caring for sentient beings, helping them release their negative behavior. And so this one in particular, as we put on our coat or jacket or cardigan or whatever it is, singlet in Queensland, to really think, I put on my cloak that protects me of my vows and my professional conduct. And so then even if our mind goes a little crazy during the day, we can feel protected by our professional code of conduct. So we can actually relax because we can be confident we're not going to act out of line. We're not going to say anything out of line. We're confident in our own activities. And then we can work on what's going on in our mind. So I'm sure there are many teachers and many nurses that when people are playing up and, you know, like in hospital, people aren't at their best, are they? And sometimes they're at their worst. And there's probably a whole lot of things that you'd like to say back to them. But, you know, nurses, infinitely patient, infinitely tolerant, even at the expense of physical harm, you know, of danger to their own life. So there is a confidence that nurses and teachers have that they're not going to snap back and say the smart ass thing, even though it may happen in their mind. But there's this really deep set code of conduct there. And, you know, that's just one step off the bodhisattva attitude, which takes that deep code of conduct and just makes the scope of it much bigger. So the scope of it isn't just dealing with this one patient or this one student, but it's for all sentient beings until they are completely liberated from suffering and all of its causes and brought to a state of lasting happiness, of enlightenment. So the scope is bigger, it's universal, and it's very long-term. It is the ultimate one. But how we do it, the attitude that we have, you know, actually putting it into practice is hardly any different than the kind of effort that we put into a professional code of conduct. So we can do it. We just in our mind have to change the aspirational scope, which we do by words, which we do as I am putting on my coat. May I be protected by my cloak of professional conduct, by my bodhisattva vows, by my bodhisattva attitude, bodhicitta attitude. So there is this formula, how it goes. We have the chore, then we hitchhike a meaning on it, metaphor. Make it match in some way so it's memorable. And then we have something that we say, which is, by me doing this action, may I attain the perfection of patience, the perfection of generosity, the perfection of ethical conduct. And by doing this, lead all sentient beings out of suffering and into lasting, authentic happiness. So that's the responsibility part. So we've got the chore, the metaphor, the aspirational prayer, and the responsibility. Not only may I attain the perfection of patience, but may I attain the perfection of patience and then lead everyone out of frustration and into the peace of liberation and enlightenment. So there's this momentum there from the chore all the way to universal responsibility. And it's all there tied into just getting dressed. So then instead of having it as a cause of stress of, oh my God, I've got nothing to wear, it's not going to be. It might take, well, it won't even take that long to get dressed, because it takes longer to get dressed not knowing what to wear than putting it on and having all of this just happening, ticking over in your mind. And then we use it to make merit. Instead of using up our merit, we're creating more. And then there's this beautiful dedication. So we've transformed from a tedious chore into kind of like an enlightenment hack. And then the dedication. And especially if you put effort into trying to make yourself beautiful, due to all the merits of the three times accumulated by me and by others, merely by seeing, hearing, remembering, touching, or talking to me, may any being be freed in that very second from all their sufferings, diseases, spirit harms, negative karmas, and obscurations, and abide in the peerless happiness of full enlightenment forever. So it's a really wonderful dedication to do, and it's kind of what I call stealth dharma, you know, that you have all of this really powerful dedications behind getting dressed, going out into the world, and then anyone that sees you, makes any connection with you at all, whether they enjoy seeing you or whether they get really cross at you, doesn't matter. You've hooked them. You've hooked them with your hook of compassion and made that connection. And because of the power of your aspirational prayers, that connection connects them to the Dharma. So Eddie was saying one of the books he was just recently reading, that one of the lamas said he never gets upset if people criticize him or don't like his teachings, or, you know, what really upsets him is if he gets no response at all, because then he hasn't made any connection. And that's what he finds upsetting, because the thing is to make the connection with living beings so that then with your hook of compassion, you have something, you're hooked to them, you can lead them out of suffering. So, you know, then when I was younger and had slightly wilder, different coloured hair, and, you know, in Queensland, and didn't get very good responses from people. And now I wish I had have had that prayer, because then everybody that's thrown stuff at me out of cars or yelled abuse at me or anything like that, then that could have been their connection to the Dharma. I could have been the connector. Anyway, at least I could do it now. So I hope this has been useful, and I hope it's given you new inspiration for getting dressed. Everyday Dharma, you know, it's very powerful. Skills for humanity, isn't it? And let's see what questions you have. June, how are you going?
Yes, I'm going very well, thank you.
Are you inspired?
Yes, I am. I've sort of, like you said, you go along your day and you go, oh, hang on a minute, I forgot to say that prayer, or hang on a minute, and then if you've done that at the beginning of your day while you're doing your chores, so to speak, and getting dressed, then you've already done a lot, and then you can just sort of be reminded, I think that is really good. That's a really good point that I hadn't really thought about.
It's a lot less energy, because otherwise throughout the day we have to go back and remotivate again, and there's no time.
Yep, all of that.
You do it in the morning, you've got the momentum started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing to do. So I'm going to have a go at that. I don't know if I'll get it like all the things, but at least if I go, okay, I'll just start with a few things, and then, you know, I think that'll be really beneficial. Because I don't really wear makeup.
but I forgot. So glasses, you know, I wear glasses. Oh, you wear glasses. So this is the Deva's eye. May I have the glasses?
Oh, okay.
May I see through the lens of wisdom and compassion?
Mm-hmm.
And also, because all of our suffering comes from distortion, from distorted views. So we put on the glasses of the wisdom of the Dharma, and our view becomes undistorted, clear.
That sounds really good.
So
that'll be very helpful. And from doing all the courses with you and with Eddie, I've learned a lot of things, like just recently, and also probably didn't know where it all came from, but now I'm understanding now, and, you know, like getting the, like you say, the analytical and the emotional connected, because before I sort of could, the analytical was happening, but I couldn't put it in the emotional state. I was still the same. So I found that has been really good, and it's challenged me in a few things. And I've at least started to recognize it and then understand it more. So that's been good. And I just wanted to share that with you, because it's been very helpful for me. And the other thing I wanted to say was right at the very end, when you were saying about the dedication and how you were saying that Eddie had read that from what the Lama had said.
Yeah.
Because I'd never thought of it that way. And this event happened to me on the weekend at work, where I did my job and they sent me home early anyway. And then they sent me, I got a note to say of all the things that I'd done wrong. They complained about me. And I thought, oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. I had to answer all of those things. And it's not happened very often. I think it's happened in my 20 years, probably about 3 times or 4 times. That's it.
Ah.
So that's been interesting. And then when you said that if there's no response, then he's upset. But if there's a response, because then you know that, you know, they've hooked into you, and they've found you. I don't know what the word is, changing or something.
It's like a martial arts move, you know, like I've seen how the punch comes towards you and they deflect the punch off with the momentum of the punch. So, you know, the complaints come towards you and you use that momentum to direct it to somewhere positive.
Yeah. Well, I realized that was really good because one of them was to do with the doctor that I spoke to. Well, I didn't think I had an argument, but they come across as having an argument. And I thought, that's really interesting that people were, and I thought pride, because it also affects me, pride, you know. And so I thought that was a really interesting, I'd not had that before.
Yeah, so the thing too with the pride that we can maybe not at the very second that it's happening, but I mean it'd be great if we could, but we can actually really use that. The first thing that happens when the pride arises is you think of it like a thermometer and you go, here's the degree of my self-cherishing. So not getting judgmental about yourself, but it's a very accurate reading. Because we cannot gauge the degree of our self-cherishing and self-grasping when we're in a neutral state, just sitting there meditating, having a nice time, not talking to anyone. We can only gauge the state of it when we're in conflict. So you get a complaint and then the thermometer goes up and sometimes it goes all the way up and blows a gasket. And other times it just goes up a bit and you go, that's interesting. Mm. But it doesn't destroy you, you know, it doesn't throw you so off kilter.
Because I've realized that from you know the classes that I've been doing, that I can actually, before I just get really upset or be worried all the time, but now I realize that it's just, and I can sense it and I go, that's the pride, my pride coming up, and then I go, yeah.
And then because you can name it and you can see what it is, then the pride comes up, but it doesn't have to dominate everything. And so that in itself, actually, then it is also very practical, because when we're not dominated by that extreme reaction to our pride being hurt, you know, if we can release that, we can just see it for what it is, then we can actually respond much more appropriately. And then we can stand up for ourselves in a far more cool-headed way that's less likely to backfire on us and all of those things by relinquishing the pride. So it doesn't mean being a doormat. It actually means then we've got more of a chance of working very creatively with the situation, or knowing the thing to say to the person that's going to have an effect. Rather than just normally with pride, it's retaliation, isn't it?
Or it is.
Or hiding away and becoming all meek, and then
that's not good either. I usually do. I hide away and don't say anything because I go,
Yeah, me too. And so, I mean, the good thing is that you haven't retaliated. The bad thing is that a whole lot of misunderstandings just continue.
Yes, that's it. So I wrote about how I didn't see it at all like that, and and apologized if it came across that way.
So that's the one part is to, if we can relinquish the pride, that's that one of almost like you give the victory to others and take the blame. But it's not just like Eddie's been saying in the classes, it's not how we first hear it. Who's taking the blame is our pride.
That's
not
right.
Us as a spiritual practitioner. It's our pride takes the blame. That's the one, our pride caused all the problems in the first place. And when we give the victory to others, what we're doing is actually acknowledging they have a point of view. And it's only if you acknowledge that point of view that you've even got a way of communicating or changing the situation, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. But it's also had a bigger effect on me as well, because of, you know, I'm getting to the end of my working life and thinking, what am I going to do? And being a bit nervous about stopping. And so that's sort of made me sort of look at everything and realize I don't have to cling on to this role of being a nurse, because that's what I've always done. Because people say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a nurse. Well, that's fine. Everyone's happy with that. And they talk to me, sort of thing, you know. But if you say I'm retired, or I'm a single parent or something, they go, oh, okay, nothing to talk about.
Yeah, that's so right. You're nothing.
That's right. So that's been really good to sort of look at that, because I've clung on to that role of being a nurse. So now I go, oh, that's interesting. Now I can sort of start to let that go and develop my, you know, use all the skills that I've learned from that and all the training, like you said, to develop my inner professional
in
a different way.
Because,
yes.
I mean, that's what a bodhisattva is, isn't it? Is an inner nurse, and especially in the emergency department. Yeah. Because in a Dharma center, it's like an emergency. Rinpoche said over and over again, it's an emergency rescue operation.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I sort of beings in distress.
Yeah, and I've put that all together, because that's how I started coming. Because when my son was killed, and I didn't know where to turn to or what to do, then I've always been interested in Buddhism. But then I thought, well, I've got to do something, and that's how I came, you know, originally. So yes, people do come.
Yeah. So
for that reason,
you've got probably a whole lot of fortitude from your professional life that you can transfer that to the inner life.
Mm. And also realizing that that's of great value to do that, because you think when you're in the outside world, you think that's what you've got to be going out there doing stuff because that's your value. And then with then you become to realize that it's just out there. And the most important thing is what's going on in here.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and otherwise,
really interesting.
If you can't keep doing out there, and either it comes like with retirement or burnout.
Yes.
And then if everything is being based on the physical activities only, then it can be really distressing, you know, because you lose your identity, you lose your reason for life, what also gives you that sense of satisfaction. So, it's crucial to bring it inwards. What to actually say to people it is that you do. Oh, I'm an inner nurse. It doesn't make any sense.
No. Say what? What do you mean? Or they'll just have a puzzled look.
You know, and a lot of people will say, oh, I'm a retired nurse, or I'm a retired something to lend legitimacy. But even then, when we say something like that, we can set our motivation of why. So if you say you're a retired nurse with a motivation that it's an indicator for people to feel safe with you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then that way it doesn't have to go into pride and identity. Mm. You can be proactive about it and go, why am I saying this? What's the best thing to say?
Mm.
So I found this when I went on a holiday, on a cruise. So I'm with people that I like, you know, never spend any time with. And each day the question would come up, what do you do? And so each day I would try out an answer, and every single one of them was a complete conversation stopper. So the first night I said, oh, I lead classes at a Buddhist center. Oh, that's interesting.
That's it.
And that was it. No one said anything to me for the rest of the night. And so then I tried the next night. I tried, oh, I'm a manager at a Buddhist center. Oh, that must be hard. And that was it, nothing. So then I tried the next night. I tried doing, oh, I teach adult education classes. Oh, right. What do you teach? It's like, oh, you know, overcoming disturbing emotions. Oh, that's interesting. End of the conversation. Just went on and on. So, you know, it depends if you want to have a conversation or not. So nights when I just wanted to stay by myself, I just say, oh, I lead Buddhist classes, and that was it. I'd be free. And then other nights if I wanted to have a chat, then I'd say, you know, I lead adult education classes in goal setting and making your life meaningful. And oh, right. But I was really shocked. I had no idea, because if anybody had said that to me, I would have just been right in there. What do you reckon about this? What do you reckon about that? But if your whole life is focused on the external, that's just, it's kind of confronting. It's like this vacuum. It opens up a vacuum that people are very uncomfortable about. So in the end, all I could do was just set my motivation that anybody who saw the weird pink-haired person on the cruise, that that may that be their connection with an inner life, with you know, a path to liberation and enlightenment. And that's pretty much all I could do, really. But funnily enough, I did make really good friends with one lady who was like 87 and a pensioner and an absolute stalwart Christian. And so when she found out I was a Buddhist, she said, "Oh, I knew you must have been, you know, someone special or something. You would have been a really good Christian." And I was so chuffed by that. I thought, that's really high praise. And so we just hung out together, this 87-year-old lady, really frail and little, and I'd go and find wherever the churches were and say, "Oh, there's a really great church here and there, and let's go." And off we'd go. And we were excellent friends on the whole time, because she was genuinely interested in the inner life.
Yeah, yeah. How interesting. Yeah. Oh, well.
So
there you go.
Yes. I hope that's been food for thought and enthused you. So
yes.
when you put your coat or cardigan on, your glasses, brush your hair. I forgot to say about doing your teeth. You know, that's also with the speech. And I think the teeth are also the two truths, you know, the two sets of teeth. And what else is there? Even like, you know, you've got earbuds in for the class today. So if you don't have earrings, as you put your earbuds in, you can think about the perfection of patience. So it's really, it's finding, looking at the, you know, the top 10 things that you do every single day, and then hitchhiking a Dharma meaning onto them. And then you already have the momentum of those things that you're doing. So it becomes very easy. And after a while, it'll be automatic. So it won't even take a month. It'll just take a couple of weeks. And now I've got to the stage where I don't forget. You know, I put on my mascara and that's what I'm thinking. May I have the Deva's eye. And it's just part of the routine. You know, with the teeth, with the four quadrants, you know, you're supposed to do 30 seconds on each of the four quadrants. Then I think about the Four Noble Truths and the toothbrush goes bzzz when it's time to go over to the next three. So very, very little effort once you set it up.
Yep. Sounds good. Sounds like a bit of fun too.
So I hope I've enthused you about the secret life of life maintenance.